Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here at our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in downtown Ames, Iowa, right in the middle of Iowa. And this is a special time for KHOI Community Radio because we want to remind you that we come to you and are in your ears because you support us, and thank you for that support. To renew your membership, to become a member, to get involved with this radio station, go to khoifm.org/membership. It's a good thing. Well, spring planting. Is it time for gardens?
Spring, we're still in spring wishing.
Well, but still it's going on, spring planting, the gardens and then farms.
I read a thing in the news today that spring planting for, you know, like corn and soybeans and stuff is actually ahead of the usual. Oh. I don't know why.
So here we go. Here we go. There's gardens, there's farm, but there's also big farms, especially here in Iowa. There's a lot going on here in the Midwest. Along with the seeds that go into the ground, big agriculture has come to depend on a growing amount of agricultural chemicals. What's this doing to our environment? And more importantly, what is all of this doing to us? I mean, there's herbicides, there's pesticides, there's all kinds of stuff that we
forever
perhaps,
chemicals. Oh, my goodness.
We perhaps do not like to always think about that sort of thing.
No, it's definitely a doom and gloom thing.
But we are here at the Donald on the Kitchen to talk about these things.
And yes, you know, we have options, some options.
We're going to talk about it today. So, joining us at our kitchen table today is Audrey Tran Lam. Welcome, Audrey.
Hi.
So Audrey manages the Environmental Health Program at the University of Northern Iowa Center for Energy and Environmental Education, working where human health and environmental sustainability meets. Well, that's a big deal, Audrey. A lot on your shoulders there.
Thanks for the acknowledgement.
Well, we asked Audrey to be on the show today because we wanted to talk about an ongoing study, scientific study, to kind of evaluate how these pesticides and herbicides are affecting us. Now, scientific studies take a long time, you know, because they have to prove without doubt. And, you know, I prefer, of course, the precautionary principle, which is, you know, do no harm. Let's try to prevent it. But on some of these issues, we've flown way past that. So Audrey is on the board of the Heartland Health Research Alliance. So tell us about this particular study.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me start off by telling you a little bit about the Heartland Health Research Alliance, or HHRA. The mission of this organization is really to inform the decisions that shape agriculture by advancing research on the health effects of food and farming and the impacts, the health impacts. Really, we're thinking about population-based impacts of the way that we currently farm, and specifically looking through a Midwestern context, a Midwestern lens. The Alliance is made up of scientists, physicians who have sort of come to this this question, you know, like, what is food and farming doing to public health, especially to the populations living in the heartland, and how do we find out those answers that maybe we haven't really asked, you know, to the answers to the questions that we haven't really asked up until this point. You know, I really like what you were saying earlier, Donna, about, you know, you being sort of coming from this precautionary principle-minded angle in how you think about chemicals and environmental exposures. And I find myself thinking about these problems from a similar vantage point. The thing is that, you know, with these very, what we hope to be very rigorous scientific studies, when we look at environmental variables, it can be very difficult to come to the very solid conclusions that we would normally really like to have in order to make those, you know, either social or political decisions to protect public health. And in a lot of cases, it's sort of unethical to do those studies in a way that might give us those very definitive answers, right? We can't just expose one cohort of babies to an herbicide and find out what happens, right? So we sort of have to...
Well, thank goodness we can't do that, right?
Right. Very, very unethical. And so we have to sort of think about how to design studies in order that allows us to look at the bigger picture without, you know, purposefully exposing large groups of people.
Yeah, that's where we use mice and things like that, right?
Right. Animal studies, right? Or just like taking samples of people who, just by virtue of where they live, may or may not be exposed to, you know, certain chemicals. And so the Heartland Health Research Alliance has set up this study, the Heartland study, that looks at a big portion of the Midwest, a big portion of the Heartland. And
agricultural areas, basically, right?
Yes. Exactly, exactly. Places like Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Indiana, mm-hmm. right? The heartland where a lot of this very particular Midwestern economic or agricultural economic activity.
Corn and soybeans, yes.
Exactly, exactly. So things that we're very, very used to seeing here in Iowa.
Well, and part of this is for our audience, I want to stick this in here. Corn and soybeans, which are mostly genetically engineered, have been specifically genetically engineered so that the pesticides and herbicides that are used prolifically do not affect the corn and the soybeans. They just obliterate other things. And it's right. Those herbicides and pesticides that we're worried about.
Exactly. And I think, like, let's take a pause on this point of GMO crops briefly, because I think this is definitely a really important point for sort of everybody, especially those of us who live in the Midwest, to understand. It was something that I didn't learn about or really wrap my head around until, I would say, much, much later in my own life, that sort of drove my interest in the topic of agriculture and environmental exposures to begin with. But right, we have now these genetically modified seeds for our two main commodity crops, corn and soy, that allows them to sort of withstand what an herbicide would normally do to them, which would be kill them, right? So we can spray entire fields of corn.
Yes, herbicide means kill plants. Herb,
right.
Aside, kill.
Herbicide, exactly. And you can spray an entire field without harming the actual commodity crop, but killing everything else that hasn't been genetically modified, which would be all the weeds. And I do want to back up too and define pesticide, because sometimes I think that can be kind of a confusing term for people who don't, you know, think about these exposures or agriculture very often. But I think sometimes there's a little bit of confusion when folks hear the term pesticide, and they immediately think that it refers to an insecticide, something that kills bugs. But actually, a pesticide is a term that refers to a whole host of chemicals that are designed to harm or eliminate a pest. And pests can be weeds, you know, they can be dandelions. They can be cockroaches or spiders. They could be rodents. They could even be bacteria. So a pesticide really could be referring to an herbicide, an insecticide, a rodenticide, a fungicide, a biocide. These are all things with an active ingredient that's designed to eliminate the things
yes,
you want to get rid of.
Yes, and side always means to kill it.
To kill it, right.
Dead.
So... we in the Midwest, we're usually, and we're talking about GMO crops, we're usually thinking about herbicide resistance. So we're really thinking about these particular weed-killing products.
Yes, glyphosate.
But sometimes, sometimes I'll switch in between and say sort of pesticide, but I'll usually be referring to herbicide just in this conversation, just for your listeners' understanding.
Well, and pesticides are an issue, too, with the seed coverings and various other things, too, that are ubiquitous in our environment. So we are dealing with all of that here. And the point that we need to remember is, yes, we've been using these chemicals a long time, but with the growing use of the GMO seeds, there's a thing called tolerance, which Audrey, I hope you'll explain, but the amount of herbicides or insecticides or pesticides used has grown exponentially even in the last, what, even 4 or 5 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, I think we really need to get our executive director, Dr. Chuck Benberg, on here to give you names, dates, trade names, all of the really nitty-gritty details on how and why the this sort of herbicide boom has occurred in the Midwest. But it has definitely been driven by the advent and introduction of these GMO seeds, especially in soy. You know, we have these dicamba-ready soybean varieties now, which...
Tell us what dicamba is.
Yeah, absolutely. So dicamba is an herbicide that is unfortunately highly volatile, and its volatilization has been a growing problem here in Iowa. Some of your listeners may have heard about dicamba drift. When this very volatile chemical, volatile just means sort of like it won't stay where you put it.
Right, it doesn't sit still.
Right, it doesn't sit still. It kind of feels like me after a couple of cups of coffee. But you spray it on a very hot or windy day, and the chemical will volatilize and drift away, either onto a neighboring field that may not have the protection of these dicamba-ready genes, or onto ornamental crops, or even in urban areas, since we use dicamba on our lawns and gardens as well. So dicamba is an herbicide that's highly volatile, and now we have these varieties of soybeans that are resistant to it, allowing applicators to apply it to an entire field if it's an especially weedy one.
And dicamba has only been recently added, I don't know, in the last 5 or more years, to the, you know, genetic traits. I mean, dicamba resistance has been added to the genetic traits because glyphosate, which was the original herbicide that was used, was becoming less and less effective, because the thing with these substances is plants, you know, and animals and whatever, bacteria, they develop an immunity to the herbicide. And you have to either use more, and then at some point you have to add in the second one, which is dicamba, which is an older pesticide that's actually quite nasty, and people had not been using it for a while, but now they've come back to having to use it because the things that we're spraying for have become resistant somewhat to the glyphosate. So the weeds are developing, of course, resistance, as do, you know, all living organisms kind of change and grow. And am I explaining this right, Audrey? You're the scientist.
You're doing a great, great job. Yeah, I think it's the way of nature to really sort of overcome this chronic adversity. And the example of herbicide-resistant weeds is a really great case study for this. Mm-hmm. You know, over time, the strongest of those weeds, those that may not have been totally knocked down, burned down by a dose of glyphosate, those that come back, they will produce seed, they will reproduce and have that genetic je ne sais quoi that allows the next generation to also be a little bit more resistant to that same chemical. Right. Go for it.
Well, and because of this growing resistance, we keep using more and more and more of these chemicals, which is why our population exposure has just exploded. They have to use more to make it kill the weeds in the field.
Exactly. And I was going to actually like get into a little bit of maybe, I don't think psychology is the right word for it, but you know, when we first
plant psychology, right?
Yeah, plant and people psychology, right? But when we first introduced the, you know, glyphosate or Roundup Ready corn varieties, right? It sort of was a, like, this is a silver bullet. This is going to keep these fields clean. This is going to keep the weeds down. And so it sort of allowed for this blanketed use of a chemical that we really hadn't seen prior to that. But like you were saying, Donna, as the resistance of these weeds began,
maybe only a short period of time, like 10 years or so, the resistance.
it wouldn't take very, very long.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you use more and more and more. And, you know, from a public health standpoint and thinking of chemicals in the environment and exposure, that becomes, at least at the very least, an issue of concern, something that we should be looking into, especially given that even though it has its toxic traits, its toxic concerns, glyphosate is one of the more safe herbicides on the market. And so when it loses efficacy and we have to be shifting towards
dicamba,
these maybe more potent and older herbicide technologies, that does become a much more serious question for public health. Layering, mixing herbicides, doing multiple passes, just the volume needed. Mm-hmm. Already in Iowa, we use about 50 million pounds of active ingredients of herbicides alone in the state annually. And that's, you know, again, we're only talking herbicides here. So we're not including fungicides to this tally. We're not including insecticides or other agrochemicals. So there's a lot of stuff that we're swimming in, a lot of this mixture that is sort of that we're now living in.
It not only, it doesn't just stay on the farm. It goes into the ground, then it goes into the water. Some of it's in the air. This is not just a problem that farmers are having. This is a statewide health consideration, right?
I like you, coming from a sort of precautionary, principle-minded point of view, would agree with that. Right. It's not in question at all whether or not these chemicals stay put. And of course, we just talked about dicamba, that being a really good example about how chemicals don't really like to stay
drift,
where they're planted.
Yeah.
Right. But they, you know, they have shown up in our water. They show up in our air, right? This atmospheric loading term that popped up when we were confronted with so much dicamba drift in 2018 and 2019. So it's very, very well understood that these chemicals are sort of at large in the environment. What we need to figure out is what that means, how much of it is at large in our environment, and if there are any populations that are particularly vulnerable to this kind of environmental
insult.
Well, that's what studies like the Heartland study is seeking to find out. And this is, I should say, the study, the Heartland study, is layered on top of really just a constellation, a very rich constellation of existing body of evidence that points to the direction that maybe this amount of environmental exposure, this low dose chronic exposure, is something that we need to be a little concerned about, especially from the point of view of, like I was saying earlier, more vulnerable populations. And with my public health hat on, it's those populations that we're really concerned about just in general keeping safe.
Okay, so let's be specific who the populations are.
Yes. Well, we have several of those populations living in Iowa, right? Of course, we have children, small children, and they're vulnerable for a variety of different reasons. You know, as we are growing in utero, as we are in our infancy and very, very early life, we're very vulnerable to external or exogenous environmental insults. Just because we are moving through these very rapid and very critical stages of development that, if interrupted by, you know, chemicals or endocrine disrupting compounds, can really impact us later in life. So we've got children, we have rural populations that are another vulnerable population, and they're because maybe they lack access to some of the infrastructure that may keep them a little bit safer, a little bit more insulated environmental exposures. And they have a limited access to care. So healthcare, hospitals, transportation may be a little bit more difficult. There's just lots of social barriers that may limit their, keeping them a little bit safer than maybe an urban population.
Well, are we thinking that because they live where all of this kinds of farming activity is happening, and it's got to, and a lot of them are on private wells, so their water isn't getting quite the same treatment as urban areas, and it's got to be in bigger. It's not just that it does affect people who live in cities too. It's just that the rural population, maybe it's more obvious because their exposures are a little higher. Is that?
That's a really important clarifying point. Yes, it's not only the environment in which they're situated that might be proximity-wise, closer to exposure, but also because, like you were saying, the infrastructure might not be there to maybe filter water or to get it treated like some urban centers might. So those are two really, really good examples of the structural kind of issues that make a rural population maybe a little bit more at risk or vulnerable. And the final population that I was thinking of, and I'm starting to think a little bit more of actually, especially within an urban context from our work at the center with urban pesticide application and exposure, is the elderly. You know, what sort of physiological attributes do we, I think maybe acquire is a good word, as we age that makes us a little bit more vulnerable to chemical insults in our day-to-day lives? So these are some populations that I think about. I'm especially interested in early life exposures because that sets you up for a whole lifetime of potential problems depending on what you were exposed to, how much of it you were exposed to, and for how long you were exposed to it.
You mentioned urban applications. We haven't even discussed those. Tell us about your work with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that was one of the things that really dipped my toes into the public health implications of chemicals in the environment. So back in 2017, I started working at the Center for Energy and Environmental Education at the University of Northern Iowa. And I took over managing a program called Good Neighbor Iowa. It's a statewide public education campaign that looks specifically at pesticides in public spaces and how to reduce application of those pesticides to protect children's environmental health, urban water quality, urban pollinators, and pets. So many of the same herbicides that we apply in an agricultural setting, we actually apply in an urban in an urban setting as well. Dicamba being one of those chemicals, 2,4-D being one of those chemicals, and of course Roundup or glyphosate. So we do education about the impacts to children's early life and children's health.
Well, you're talking about lawns and gardening here, right?
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Broadcast. Bingo! Yeah.
These chemicals. Yes. So around this time of year when we're all thinking and itching to get into our gardens to, you know, start mowing our lawns and seeing flowers start to pop up. We're also seeing maybe flowers that we've been conditioned to not want to see pop up in our green spaces, like dandelions or violets, creeping Charlie, and a whole host of other things. We're trying to do something a little bit different at Good Neighbor Iowa, which is sort of flip the script on lawn care and biodiversity and really see those dandelions, those violets, those small flowering plant communities in our urban spaces as being a hallmark of a healthy environment for our kids, for our pets, and our pollinators. And also to provide urban organic lawn care techniques to those who do prefer a clean, green-looking lawn, but without the use of synthetic chemicals.
Good, good. We're talking to Audrey Tronolum about the public health implications of all this stuff that's in our air and water and on our farm fields and in our gardens. You're listening to KHOI Community Radio. This is the Donalana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. This station and the Donalana Kitchen are here because of you.
In these days of climate change, we are all thinking about renewable resources, and you can think of KHOI as a renewable resource for you and other Central Iowa listeners. Like all renewable resources, KHOI is there for you every day, 365 days a year, powering you through your day with great music, local and international news, and intriguing talk shows. And it's a renewable resource that relies on your renewed support to provide the quality programs you have come to trust and love. Like all renewable resources, except maybe the sun, it takes careful stewardship to keep it going. That's where you come in. Please go to our website, khoifm.org/membership, and make your contribution to the station. Since KHOI is a renewable resource that keeps coming back to you each and every day, consider being a renewable resource that comes to us every month. Tell us you want to give your contribution as an automatic withdrawal from your bank account. That way, we can depend on a steady source of income, and you don't have to think about it. So please, go to our website, khoifm.org/membership, and help make this renewable resource a renewable resource. Thank you.
This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We bring you information you need to know. Do you drink the water? Do you breathe the air? Do you eat food? Well, there's some things we might want to know. We're talking to Audrey Tran Lum about public health implications of all the stuff that we're kind of right in the middle of here in, well, as Donna calls it, the belly of the agricultural beast.
Yes, the belly of the beast. But we're actually talking with Audrey about lawns, which is,
oh,
even if you're not a farmer, you probably have a lawn. And, well, Lana and I for several years have been making Creeping Charlie jokes because that's what's in my organic lawn.
I was thinking, I was just listening to your introduction, Lana, and I was thinking about, like, wow, this conversation has already had so many twists and turns because of how just connected chemicals in the environment make every sort of aspect of our lives. And we move from agriculture, now we're into the urban environment. This could easily take us into, you know, our personal care products, our cleaning products, right? There's a through line of chemical intrusion in our environment. But yes, let's stick with lawns for a little bit longer before I get too lost in all of it. But Creeping Charlie, yes, I think that one of the word that's coming to mind is complaints. It's not the word that I want to use, but it's the word that's coming to mind. But that one of the biggest complaints that I get from folks about their lawns and sort of questions about what to do about it is the Creeping Charlie problem.
Yeah, if you want to go chemical-free, and you can put up with a few dandelions, but, you know, I've been having a chemical-free lawn for more than 15 years, and I mostly have a lot of Creeping Charlie. I mean, we just mow over it. So my neighbors, the neighbors that have these perfectly green manicured lawns are doing it through things that I am not willing to do to myself and to my pets and to the environment. It's a landowner's country. Everybody gets to do on their own land what they want. But you guys have this wonderful campaign about how to go chemical free on your lawns.
Yeah, yes, and we really focus on the why of chemical-free because mm-hmm. I think that frees up a lot of the maybe guilt that some people have with going that direction because we are conditioned to have that mentality of seeking out that clean, green lawn because I think that a lot of times we associate that picture, that golf course lawn, as being a good neighbor instead of really thinking about what it means to your neighborhood if you forego the chemicals and really embrace that biodiversity like
you want to know my little secret for appeasing the neighbors who probably are aghast at my lawn. I just put a lot of flowers in, you know, at strategic places because the flowers look beautiful and hopefully their eyes are drawn to, you know, the flower beds and the big pots of overflowing summer blooms, you know, and I hope that keeps them happy because I'm not spraying stuff on my lawn. Good.
That's a good technique, Donna. I like it.
It's called community appeasement, right?
Good.
I think so, yeah.
Well, so that's the thing about lawns is, you know, these chemicals do, you know, affect you and your, you know, your pets that are running around outside or if you've got a young toddler that's crawling around in the grass and having a marvelous time, you want to keep those chemicals away from them. So, so in the Heartland study, which we've been talking about, so it was, it's based on the work of Dr. Chuck Benbrook, And he is actually an old friend of mine, but he also is the he's known as the expert witness in the Roundup litigation trials. And so he's kind of become a little bit famous. And, you know, I'm sure he's had some unpleasant experiences by standing up to large corporate agricultural communities and companies. Because in the California cases where Dr. Benbrook was the chief expert witness, they've had some resounding, very expensive settlements for people with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which has been attributed to glyphosate exposure. So Chuck Benbrook has started this study. So tell us a little bit about the study, how long it takes, what are you thinking?
Absolutely. Happy to. So yes, we've gotten sidetracked a couple times, but I'm glad we're circling back here to think about this really, really important study. And the purpose of the study really is to seek answers to those questions that sort of maybe haven't been asked or have been asked, but we just haven't had the resources or organization.
Yeah, we don't have definitive answers, right?
Right, those definitive answers. So the Heartland study is looking to enroll pregnant mothers and their babies into a cohort of women that are expecting. We'll collect their urine, we'll collect a cheek swab to assess what, if any, pesticides, in particular, in this case, herbicides, they've been exposed to. And then following the child for a few years to determine if any developmental outcomes, you know, developmental challenges have arisen based on their level of exposure.
So we're talking like 5 years, 10 years or something like that?
I think it's going to be closer to 3 years, depending on funding. If we can get more funding, then there'll be, of course, a longer follow-up. But in addition to all of the sort of immediate, maybe birth outcomes, you know, weight status, all of those things that get measured directly after you're born, we're looking at those developmental outcomes. Moms will be given these questionnaires, looking at dietary patterns, looking at variables in their environment, taking their medical history. So we'll be able to weed out a lot of variables that make studies like these, looking at environmental exposures, really challenging to do. They're hoping to enroll about 2,000 mother-infant pairs, and we currently have hospitals exclusively in the Midwest, mm-hmm. because the way that we farm here is a little bit different than different parts of the world, and so we want to know what the effect of these agricultural practices have on the populations living here. And again, these are vulnerable populations that we're looking at.
And how long does a study have to go on before there is conclusive scientific evidence?
That depends on enrollment rates, and that depends on the hospitals that we have enrolling mother-infant pairs, because we want enough of them to have a strong enough statistical power to be able to draw those conclusions that we're looking for. So right now, we have hospitals in Indiana, Wisconsin, and newly enrolling in Iowa. I'm very, very excited to have the University of Iowa, right, bringing on women into the study. So that's really the gist of the Heartland study. We're going to be looking at exposures in urine, following babies, looking at their birth outcomes to see if there's any evidence to support exposure leads to certain or the probability of certain outcomes.
So you're only looking for metabolites of herbicides?
Yes. At this point, herbicides. But we will have their urine bank. So if funds come up, we may be able to extend what it is that we're looking for later down the road. But this study is only looking at herbicides right now, because really we're swimming in them here in the Midwest.
And can you explain, first of all, what epigenetic factors, what that means, and is that what you're looking for?
Very complicated question. And I'm not an epigeneticist, but I'm happy to try to disambiguate.
Just the broad strokes, yeah.
Broad strokes. So epigenetics, we can break down this word a little bit. Epi meaning above, genetics. So the term is above genetics, or we can think about epigenetics as being the study of or looking at the influence of environment on our genes, on our DNA. So the way that I think about the gene-environment interaction is that your genes are really, I've had this explained to me before like this, and I think it's a really useful analogy, if not the most pleasant one. But your genes are the gun, but the environment pulls the trigger. So really looking at the interaction between the two, sort of like what are we genetically predisposed to maybe exhibit in our phenotype, in our life, you know, what diseases we may succumb to versus how much of the environment is actually causing those things to come to fruition. So we are in a lot more control of our genetic destiny than I think we're told a lot of the time. And so epigenetically looking at just sort of, like I said, how environment interacts with your genome. We are noticing, like in the literature, we are noticing that there is a trend that chemicals in the environment, these sort of ever-present, very ubiquitous chemical insults in our environment can trigger some gene expression that maybe wouldn't normally get turned on that can result in negative health outcomes throughout one's
life. Right. We're talking things like cancer, Parkinson's disease, learning disabilities, those mm-hmm. kinds of things. Especially if you're going to do young children, you're going to look for a learning disabilities or, you know, that kind of thing, right?
Right, exactly. So that's sort of my grasp on epigenetics there. Mm-hmm. Definitely have to recommend you someone who can give a much more complete picture for your listeners, because this is a very, very important topic, and it's
a word you're going to hear again and again and again. So
absolutely, a new
word. Yes, good. Well, are there any things we can do? I mean, all right. Is there any way to stop the dumping of all this stuff on our food? I mean, are there alternatives, or do we just have to deal with it at the consumer end?
That's a very, very good question. The first thing that I want to say about that is I think that, so much in the food and farming system goes on without our knowledge. For many reasons, we're not connected to our food system really in the degree that we really should be. And so when people learn about some of the stuff that we're talking about today for the first time, they're shocked because they've been left out of the loop for so long. And then they have these questions, like you were saying, Lana, about, you know, what can we do? Is this completely out of our control, or is there something that I can do about it? It does look like the majority of pesticide exposure, like we're looking specifically at the chemical class of pesticides, whether that's herbicides or insecticides, what have you, comes from, the majority of our pesticide exposure, that being of herbicides, comes from our diet. And as consumers, we usually do have a lot of control over what it is that we eat. You know, there are some circumstances that make it a lot more difficult to shop organic, sort of depending on where you live or your income, that kind of a thing. But we do have some control there. However, you know, depending on where it is that you live, you may be eating an exclusively organic diet and still get some exposure just based on proximity.
We're simply talking about at least reducing the possibilities of exposure.
Yes, absolutely. I always point to diet as being one of the first things to look at, but also, your regular household use of these chemicals. So if you're applying, if you're broadcasting weed killer of your lawn or garden, something that's very easily cut out of your daily habits, you know, your health exposure. Really being critical of the kind of flea and tick medication that you give to your pets, Watching your insecticide use inside of the home, trying to eliminate that if possible. Things like that. Just being very, very aware that these are real chemicals with real active ingredients that are designed to harm and eliminate certain things that we deem as pests. And don't necessarily that probably have some other impacts in the environment, whether that's on humans, whether that's on your pets, whether that's on water quality, that we just need to be a little bit more aware of.
Well,
so I'm not quite sure if that answers your question.
No, it does, but don't despair. It doesn't mean that you have to have a house that's ridden with fleas and infestations. There are actually, like, for example, one of my favorite things is the thing called diatomaceous earth, which is this white powder that's actually made up of the skeletons of some kind of small bug, and it's ground up. And should you get fleas, you can sprinkle it around, run it into the carpet and the bedding, and the fleas eat it and they die.
It does work.
It works. There are organic, quote, alternatives to some of these heavy toxins.
I want to mention again that this is KHOI and you're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more at khoifm.org and support us by going to khoifm.org/membership. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Well, we're talking about
food.
Food and
diet.
Things we eat. And my goodness, there's lots out there. And we're awful glad that somebody is finally taking this seriously and looking at what effect all of this stuff is having on us. Evidently, the scientists were ever so nice to create GMO crops that aren't affected by all these chemicals, but they forgot to change us. We're not GMO
at least not yet.
Yeah. So this is important. This is important.
Well, Audrey, you were talking about diet. One of my favorite things is, and let me know what you think of this, is the Environmental Working Group for years has done this thing. Every year they make a new list. It's called the Dirty Dozen, which they test a lot of fruits and vegetables, kind of, you know, the mainstays in our, this is just fruits and vegetables. And they list the 12 fruits and vegetables that have the most heavy residues of pesticides on them. Is this something that you appreciate?
Oh, I'm a huge fan of the Environmental Working Group's Dirty Dozen and Clean 15. And it's an amazing resource to consumers that are sort of dipping their toes into learning about pesticide exposure, or those of us who are very seasoned in it and want to keep up to date with
what the list changes somewhat.
The list does change. Yes, the list does change. And so it's really great, as you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about, you know, some exposures that we can't avoid, some that we can't. And even those that maybe we would consider in that category of, you know, being under our control, you know, due to a lot of different factors, we might not be able to control that much of it. So really knowing, like, what of the non-organic produce we can purchase relatively safely, that's on the Clean 15 list.
Right, they have the Clean 15 and the Dirty Dozen, so.
Yes, yes. And so you probably have the list probably closer by, or
I do. This year, and it was just announced in the last month or so, the Dirty Dozen. So these are the fruits and vegetables that you need to try to limit your quantities of, unless you can buy organic or grow your own and not put pesticides on it. So Number one is, and these are, I believe, listed in order of what has the most on it. The number one is strawberries, okay? So, you know, seek out those organic strawberries or grow your own. Number two is spinach. The number three, this one always surprises me, kale, collards, and mustard greens. Yikes! Mm-hmm. Number four is peaches. Number five is pears, then nectarines. Number seven would be apples, then comes grapes, and then hot and sweet peppers. Number 10 is cherries. Number 11 is blueberries, which we all think, oh, I need to eat my blueberries. And number 12 is green beans. Now, on the hopeful side of this, the clean 15. Now, these are vegetables that you don't have to be as concerned about. So you don't have to maybe spend your money on the organic varieties necessarily. So you're a little bit safer with these. Carrots, watermelon, sweet potatoes, mangoes, mushrooms, cabbage, kiwi, honeydew melon, asparagus, which we have a lot of right now, sweet peas, frozen, papayas, onions, pineapple, sweet corn, and avocados. Now, they do note that both the papayas and the sweet corn do have some genetically modified varieties. So kind of be careful with that. So that's a wonderful resource that can help you personally make some limitations on your exposure to these things, which I think makes people feel a little bit better. We don't want to be doom and gloom all the time.
No, absolutely. We have so much agency over our exposures. But I think when we have these conversations in the context of these really big picture problems, like the things that we can't control, we tend to move to the side of the spectrum that puts us maybe more in that doom and gloom mindset. We have so much agency over our exposure, and we really don't have to wait for any major public policy changes in our own lives to start making the changes that we know sort of the evidence is pointing to us moving in that direction of, like reducing our chemical exposures, especially pesticides, and especially if you are in those vulnerable populations, like if you're a small child or if you're pregnant. Really being aware of those things in your hyperlocal environment can do a lot of good.
Well, now in the Heartland study, in addition to, you know, taking all of the tests and stuff at the mothers, are they gathering the information of kind of like, for example, is the mother eating organic produce or is she eating conventional or is she eating even enough produce? Are you able to factor some of that in?
Yes, actually. So in addition to providing urine samples and the cheek swabs, moms will be filling out very detailed questionnaires that assesses different lifestyle factors that may think about exposure, you know, like where it is that they live, family medical history, like I said earlier, and diet. This is going to be a big one to really assess full exposures. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
You'll know where they live, so you'll know if they were in a major, like, corn and soybean community, and then you'll know what they were eating.
Yes, and we'll be able to, hopefully, with all of this information, be able to pare down all of those variables that normally make drawing conclusions so difficult. And hopefully by the end of the study, after all of the
When is the end of the study?
Well, right, that depends on our enrollment. So it depends on the hospitals, it depends on how many babies, right? So there's no definitive timeline. But we do have three hospitals actively enrolling moms and babies with the ultimate goal of having at least 2,000 to be able to publish some reliable results.
Well, just in a ballpark so that we can get our hopes up, are we talking about 5 years or 10 years? How long does it take usually?
I think that we'll be in, we'll be able to get the moms at the rate that we're going probably within the next 2 or 3 years. And so we'll have that initial data. And so I think that there will be several papers being published throughout the study. We won't have to wait until the total conclusion of the study before we're able to get some published results. But we'll be able to see this sort of in phases as the study progresses. Again, we're definitely going to need to invite Dr. Benbrook to come and lend his voice to this conversation because he can provide so many more details than I am able to just as a board member. But it's really, really exciting. It's really, really important. And I think that we'll have maybe hints of answers sooner than we think.
And, of course, you'll let us know so we can share this with our audience. We've been talking about Dr. Benbrook's work for a couple of years because it's so so appreciated. And then we wanted you, Audrey, to come on because you're our Iowa connection and, you know, are so well versed in Iowa public health issues. So this let us know.
This is good. Yes. We always worry about, that mothers should raise their children, but mothers raise their children and feed their children in lots of different ways. It sounds like your study is big enough to include those that, that breastfeed, but then there's those that just kind of, pass out whatever the animal crackers are off the shelf. And we have to remember, we're not just one sort of human being here. There's all of us.
And we are a large society.
Right, and we're all kind of swimming in this stuff, in our air and water and the food we eat. This is good. Mm-hmm. Great. Audrey, do you have anything else to add? And if people are more want more information about this sort of thing, where can they contact you or the organization?
Sure. Well, the only thing that I would add would be that I hope your listeners were able to follow sort of the twists and turns of this conversation. I obviously get very excited about this whole topic and would happily follow up with any folks that have further questions for me. But I would definitely point folks to the Heartland Health Research Alliance website, which is simply hh-ra.org, or to my center's Farming for Public Health program, that is farmingforpublichealth.org. All of our center's programming and the areas in which we work are part of, you can find them at CEEE.uni.edu to keep up to date with what it is that we're working on. And with just an open invitation to please reach out to me anytime you have questions or are interested in continuing the conversation.
Yeah, and there's also, I see you're also on the board of Pesticide Action Network, which is pretty active in Iowa. That's another resource. And then, of course, the Environmental Working Group. If you just Google EWG Dirty Dozen, it'll show you that list of vegetables and then up and the Clean 15. So those are things that you can, have a look at.
Great.
Definitely. Great places to start.
Good. Well, thank you for being with us today. This was a good talk. A public health in our life here in Iowa. Yes, it is. Well, I wonder, besides gathering here at the radio station and talking every Tuesday about things around our kitchen table here, I want to remind you to support this fine radio station. We do good things here. Good advice from the Donna Lana Kitchen.
Yes, we have a recipe for good community radio station. In a big bowl, big enough to include ideas from everyone, add 1 cup each of creativity, energy, and cooperation. Add lots of determination and hard work. Mix well with talented staff and volunteers. Season liberally with dashes of humor and perseverance. Stir it all together. Pour the mixture into a baking pan big enough to hold an FCC license and send it out on the radio.
And don't forget, the most important ingredient of all is you. Your support helps make sure that KHOI Community Radio stays on the air loud and clear. Yes. Become a member or renew your membership. Remember us here in this little studio in downtown Ames. We'd appreciate your support. Go to www.khoifm.org/membership. We come to you every Tuesday at noon. We're repeated at 7 p.m. or anytime at the station's website. And you can also find us on a podcast.
Yep. The Donna Lana Kitchen is on wherever you listen to podcasts.
So if you just can't get enough of us, there we are. We've had music by the Barn Owl Band. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
Fine engineering by Mike Murphy.